So our main speaker for the evening, Tom W. Join me in welcoming him.
I'll be host over soon. My name is Tom Whalen. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for the invitation to come out and tell my dreary story to you. I don't know when I've been to a more friendly group. In fact, you're a little too friendly, as far as I'm concerned. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're supposed to be serious here. And the enthusiasm is quite wonderful. And I just thought, kind of hoped there'd be some more new people, but the one, there's two, a man and a woman, one of each. And I hope you find out what we've all found, is that you can live soberly the rest of your life, a day at a time, if you want to. Unfortunately, who wants to, for crying out loud? I mean, let's face it, life is too damn difficult, you know, and they got these relationships and work, and I mean, it's, God, I'd rather be drunk, you know, and it just, that's not really much of a message to give at an AA meeting, though, is it? I'm supposed to talk about the evils of drink. Anyway, I just love to drink. I don't know, it sounds heretical to talk at an AA meeting about how much I enjoy drinking, but I really enjoyed it. In fact, I have a big problem with the big book, where it says, early on in the book, it says, we alcoholics are people who basically enjoy the effects produced by alcohol. Well, duh! Who wouldn't, for crying out loud? Is there anything better, really, than to be laying flat on your back, stoned out of your mind, watching the room just spin around, and if you have enough strength, you can take your leg and maybe pull it off the bed. And the moment it hits the floor, everything miraculously stops. And to me, that's controlled drinking. And I just... And I'll tell you, if I could still do it, you'd have a different speaker tonight, I'll tell you that. Because that's where I would be. We were talking on the way up. I'd like to thank my three bodyguards who came up to protect me this evening from you people. And we were talking about different people who, you know, you wonder. You know, I think maybe I've been sober too long, you know. What is it that people just continue to go and doing the same stuff over and over and over again, you know, and insanity and or death, and they still, well, can I have one more drink? You know, I mean, it's just hard to understand. Anyway, I didn't start drinking until I was in grammar school. I don't want to get it too soon. But I loved it, and I did the normal things. I went to St. Paul the Apostle Grammar School in West Los Angeles and went to Loyola High School in downtown L.A. In fact, next Saturday evening, my wife and I are going to attend a 55-year union. It's hard to believe. But I graduated when I was 2.5 years old. And but it'll be fun to see all those old people. Anyway, I got out of Loyola. I went over to Santa Monica City College, and I had been drinking now daily since I was a junior in high school. And I don't know, I was sitting in Santa Monica City College. I was either drunk or hungover or both. And I don't know, I just didn't like my life at all. Nothing to do with my drinking, I'm sure. Because that was the only high point. But I was dating this girl. I wanted to get out of town, and so I volunteered to be drafted. And that was another mistake, but you know, you never know if these things until after it's over with. And I went in the Army, and I went overseas immediately. I went to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky, which is overseas if you're a native Californian. And after that, I married this girl. I shouldn't even have dated her, but we got married and signed a suicide pact for the next 20 years. And when I got out of the Army in 1956, not only am I married to her, but I have these two little babies, two little boys born, one One getting born in 1956, one a year old. I felt like my life was over. I haven't even, God, just made no sense to me. And I went back to work for my father in the electrical contracting business, which I do today in South Orange County now. And I had some idea, being that I was drinking all through the day, every day in the Army, because I had a desk job and I could get away with it. I didn't think that drinking during the day somehow fit into the stereotypical idea of how I should behave as a husband and a father and a manager of my dad's electrical contracting business. And so I didn't drink during the day, which I don't remember whether it was a problem or not. It was all too many years ago. But I, being alcoholic and not knowing anything about that, because I have no role models at home, because nobody drank, I just, I don't understand all this kind of stuff. And I find myself nervous and uptight and kind of anxious. And I'm working on hot wires, you know, and I've got a little dangerous. So I had a couple of beers for lunch one day. Worked out very nicely. Had a much better afternoon. In fact, you new people can take that information with you tonight. And relief is literally a swallow away. Drinking beer once in a while in the middle of the day, and then I found out that beer in the middle of the day made me sleepy, and then I started having a couple of vodka tonics for lunch. And then I couldn't tell anybody about it. I can't tell my wife. She wouldn't understand my drinking during the day. My dad had a little or no use for people that even drank. And so it was going to be my little secret. And I would come home on a Friday evening and put a bottle of bourbon or scotch on the kitchen sink or vodka, whatever I was drinking that season. And my wife, you know, Sunday she would come to me and say, what did you do with that bottle you bought the other night? I said, I don't know, what do you mean? She said, well, it's empty. I said, well, maybe you had a drink out of it. I don't know. I don't want to get involved in those kind of things. I may be alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. You buy two quarts in a Friday night. You put one in the kitchen sink, you put the other one in the garage. You work bottle A and a bottle B, and the line go up and down. It's a lot of work, but it keeps your goddamn mouth shut about my drinking, and that's all I cared about. I became a bottle hider and a kind of sneaky drinker in these years. And as the drinking progressed, which it does, I don't know why that is, why a pint a day isn't enough, you know, and then all of a sudden you need more, and then it's a quart a day. And then the last 2 years of my drinking, it was two quarts a day just to stay even. I wasn't getting drunk particularly. I was just how maintaining this miserable existence of putting one foot in front of the other and just knocking out this life. And it sounded like an odd thing to say, but drinking was the only really pleasurable thing that I had going for me in my life. And I was obsessed with it, just obsessed with being able to drink and having enough to drink. And I have that great identification of when you really need a drink badly and you get to the liquor store, and the moment you pay for the bottle of vodka, you feel better. Now, there's something odd about that, but that's exactly the way I felt about it. Anyway, I don't know how it affected you, but I know it started affecting me and my emotions. I'd be the wildest, zanest guy at some party, maybe it's a club, drink 27 scotch and waters and drive half of you home. And yet maybe a few hours later, or maybe the next day, I'd be sitting in my car alone, beating my fist on the steering wheel, and what was wrong with me, was my life all going to hell, and it's all so terribly, and crying, and all this histrionic behavior. And I couldn't predict how I was going to behave. And I sought the help of psychiatrists, something we all used to do in the late 50s and early 60s. And I found a doctor I had a pretty good rapport with. And I told him about my highs and my lows and my strange growing up and all the stuff that we tell our doctors. I told him everything, except one small thing. He kept asking me, how much do you drink, Tom? And I told him 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for a heavy drinker to drink. I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker because it is, after all, a sign of manhood or adulthood for me to control and enjoy my drinking was my great obsession. I don't quite understand when I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it, and when I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it, but I couldn't see any of that in those days, and all I really wanted was to have the people get off my goddamn back and leave me alone. I go to work every day, religiously. I take the kids to Indian guides and the movies and the beach and any other goddamn thing they want to do, because Hey, I'm a good father. And so I went on that way, you know, whatever. And I saw this doctor, this psychiatrist, in and out of private therapy and group therapies, all therapies you can dream up. And what happened, because I couldn't be honest about my number one problem, is I got sicker and sicker and sicker in this guy's care. And he didn't have a prayer of helping me, because I couldn't be honest about which turns out to be my number one problem, my alcoholism. Anyway, but when you're in therapy or some program or whatever the hell it is, people get off your case and leave you alone. And they did that with me. And I was drinking and working and going to the psychiatrist and doing all this sort of stuff. And I was sitting in a little club in Beverly Hills, right around the corner from my psychiatrist's office. I had a drink since noon now. And I go in there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, have 3 or 4 double scotches, whatever I was drinking at that time. And you always look better when you leave a bar. We all do. You can look at that back bar and see that. And you relate better. You can talk better in the therapy session. And this particular day, the doctor stopped about 10 minutes into the session, and he said, "You know, you're drunk." I said, "What do you mean I'm drunk?" He said, "You look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. I assume you're drunk." I said, "Well, I had a couple of beers for lunch," which I think is my stock answer. He says, "I think a little bit more than that, a little bit more recent, is going to help me with my drinking problem. Albeit my non-existent drinking problem, but I'll go along with the gag, whatever." And he put me on heavy dose of Librium and heavy dose of Stelazine. And if I've been like I thought I was, it's a little mildly neurotic, I'll take the pills they're prescribing, but just fine, that's exactly what I did. Hell, I took them more than prescribed. I want to get well now. I want to wait around a month. And I went to see him a week later, and I said, "You know, I feel better this week than I have felt in a long time." And he said, "That's amazing. Not too soon do people get this immediate result from tranquilizing drugs." I said, "Well, I guess I'm very fortunate." I said, "Incidentally, I need another prescription." He said, "You couldn't possibly. I gave you a month's supply." I said, "Well, I must have lost them somewhere. I don't know." And incidentally, he told me not to drink with these drugs. What do they know, you know? And so I got my pockets full of wire nuts for my work and these pills, and I'm popping these things and drinking behind them and wiring these houses in Bel Air and Brentwood and Santa Monica and the Valley, and doing kitchen remodels and bathroom remodels. I don't know of any major electrical problems that went on. I don't know of any real bad fires that were caused. Hey, shit happens, you know. But anyway, I went on this way. Oh, I'm so wrong. Anyway, you know, I just drive down Wilshire Boulevard, get to a little silly corner like Wilshire and Westwood about 10 o'clock in the morning, wait for the signal to change, take about an hour and a half, and I'd come to. The lady says I ran into her car, which I suppose I could have. I'm not your best witness. And come home some nights, rip that house apart, terrorize that wife and family. Some nights come home just as peaceful as I am this evening, even more peaceful. Come home at 6, 7 o'clock at night, lay down the living room rug, take a little nap before dinner time. Sometimes I'd miss dinner, but there's other meals. And I'd get up at 11, 12 o'clock at night and go take a leak in the linen closet and go to bed. You see? My wife was losing her sense of humor over this kind of stuff, which they'll do. So she filed for divorce, the miserable bitch. Here I am, looking for a place to live. I mean, talk about, I'm the victim here. You know, this is really, really wrong. Talk about being put upon. And I got myself a one-room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork on Western Boulevard. And I had sort of a routine where I'd get up at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, sit on the edge of my wet bed from perspiration or what have you. Go to the linen closet where I'm still hiding the booze from myself. Go figure. Old habits die hard. Have my morning drink and have another one. 8 o'clock in the morning came and I had a half a pint to refine my stomach and go up and go to work, which I did every morning. And hope I would last until lunchtime. Most of the time I couldn't get past 10 or 11 o'clock. I'd start to get those trembles and terrorists would start coming at me. Excuse me, I'll be right back. I've just got to run down for the hardware store for something, ma'am. And lay down in the front seat of my car and drink a little hot vodka and get the motor running where I could last until lunchtime and I could sit at these bars. I didn't sit at the bars for people like you said. I sat at a booth and read my Herald Examiner and maybe went back to work. Maybe just went back to my little room, watched General Hospital on television, whatever seemed like the right thing to do. And that's what my life was like in 1965. My wife came to visit me in October of 65. She told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was to my mother and dad. And what was I going to do about Christmas was coming up and the kids needed toys and clothes and the attorney wants to be paid and they turn the electricity off again. I don't know what she's telling me about these things, like I'm supposed to do something. Got my own problems. Anyway, mercifully, she left in about 20 minutes, and I just sort of flipped out. I went temporarily insane, and I don't know. Fortunately for me, the night before, I just purchased 100 Secanol sleeping pills, of which I took all of those and a bunch of scotch, and I just checked out. It's an understandable thing to do, because you get to a point with your alcoholism and your drug addiction where you really can't do it anymore. I know we joke in here about this time it'll be different, I can handle it now, but realize you get to the point where it's not going to work anymore. Nothing else, nothing that's going on is working. And don't even suggest that I not drink. What the hell has that got to do with anything? They say, don't drink and drive. How the hell do you drive if you don't drink? I can't do my electrical work because you can't work on hot wires when you're shaking, so you got to be calm. I've developed a very embarrassing stammering habit that I had through grammar school. But when I had fresh alcohol in my system, I could work, I could talk, I could do anything like I do today. And so I was totally addicted to alcohol and drugs, and yet I couldn't see it at all. I just couldn't see it at all. And a kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely, and he came to my apartment, found me in this coma. And somehow they got the door open. I didn't leave any phone messages or any notes. I just wanted to get out. We were talking about a fellow who committed suicide recently, and I almost started to say, well, I can't even understand anybody doing that, and I can, because you get so hopeless, and what's the point? You just cannot go on another minute. You can't take the pain anymore. Anyway, a kid that was working for me part-time thought I found me, and they got me in, he got in the apartment, and called the ambulance, and they shipped me up to UCLA Medical Center, where they pumped me full of holes, and I was staying there for about 13 hours. In this coma, I guess they pumped my stomach and whatever they did. I don't know, I wasn't there. And I came to in this funny-looking green room, and I thought, Christ, I didn't even screw this up. Talk about bad breaks. And when my vital signs came around, they put me in another ambulance, and they shipped me off to a mental institution where I should stay for a while, but not for alcoholism, something respectable, suicide. And I was in this place, and they were very kind to me in there. I had a 24-hour guard on me. I guess they were afraid I was going to do something rash. And I had plenty of Thorazine to keep me very tranquil through that little stay. And eventually I made my little ashtray well enough they let me out. And and the first place I stopped was Jerry's Liquor Store at Olympic. And I bought a quart of vodka and a quart of scotch. And of all the things that I talk about in this phase of my talk, to me it's the most bizarre, because wouldn't you think I'd stay sober a couple of months? Couple of weeks, couple of days. But I know I can't go in my room naked with nothing to drink because I drank it all up. So I got to stop at Jerry's and get a quart of each. And I stayed drunk that weekend, but I'm drunk every day. It doesn't make any difference. And I went to work on Monday morning, and I got on the fourth rung of the ladder to change some light bulbs, which is not overly technical. And I couldn't do it. I didn't have enough to drink that morning, and the people driving to work up Sunset Boulevard were pointing at that crazy electrician up on that ladder. And they weren't, but I felt like they were. And I told the lady, I said, I'll come back another day. I said, I had the flu or some lame excuse. And I checked in with another psychiatrist. This one 5 days a week. If you're wondering how I'm affording a psychiatrist 5 days a week, I'm not. My daddy's taking care of me. I'm only 32 years old. I can't pay my bills or raise my family or do anything that any other self-respecting 32-year-old man would do. And when I Father would ask me every morning, well, what do you say about you today, Tom? Like there's going to be some revelation. And I went to Mass on Christmas of 1965. I didn't want to be around my family or friends because they knew about the suicide. They knew about the mental institution. And it was beyond embarrassing to me. But I got on my knees in the back of that church and I asked God to grant me some peace. I don't want to quit drinking, but I wanted to sleep for more than 2 hours at a time. If you drink the way I drink, getting to sleep is not a major problem because you drink all through the day, and by 8 or 9 o'clock at night after 2 quarts of booze, you're passed out, which is fine with me. I have no quarrel with that. But I pass out and I wake up in 2 or 3 hours just as wide awake as I am right now, and I can't get back to sleep unless I pace that room back and forth and back and forth and drink some more and walk some more so I can wear myself out and pass out again and wake up in 2 or 3 hours. That's what my life had been reduced to in 1965. And I want to ever go back to that again, anything remotely like it. And so I 2 days later, nothing new had happened in my life. There was no new trauma. And I woke up one morning, I went to my linen closet and poured my morning drink, and then another one, 8 o'clock in the morning came, and I went and put the bottle back on the top shelf, and I noticed a bottle of Ballantine's scotch had about that much left. And I thought, Christ, that's a lot of scotch since 8 o'clock the night before. It was remarkable how much I was drinking, and it was no more or no less that I was drinking all the way along, but it was kind of like shown to me. And I went to the phone a few hours later, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous of all places. And I went to a meeting that night at Ohio Street in West Los Angeles. And I sat in the back of the room. We still sit in your new, don't get too close. And most meetings you have coffee cups, and here they don't. But if you go to the meeting, they have coffee cups. Don't have one with you because they'll think you're a member. And and I was sitting back in my hands because I was afraid somebody's going to see me shaking. Because I was sitting on my hands, and I was purple in color. And I was sweating profusely on this cold January night, and I had green slime coming out of my mouth and the breath purifier was I was chewing, so no, I was drinking. And some jerk who I was sitting next to raised my hand as a newcomer, which really pissed me off. I mean, bad form. And I don't even know today how he knew I was a newcomer, because I didn't tell him, I'll tell you that. But that was the night I was going to walk up to, I met my sponsor, who was the secretary of the group that year. He said, excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? How do you become a member? And he says, you don't drink, kid. And I said, yes, I'm planning on cutting down. And he said, no, you don't have a grasp of it wrong. You don't drink here a day at a time. I said, it's very easy for you to say, if any, you're sober sometime. But I can't go a whole day without a drink. I tried it one day in July and it damn near killed me. He thought that was so goddamn funny, and he got some of the guys he sponsored and dragged them around me and made me repeat what I had just said, you know, so he could laugh out of it. I thought it was outrageous at the time, but when you think about it, if you can't exploit and make fun of the new people, what good are they? And so I went back to my psychiatrist and told about these insane AA meetings and these crazy people and these bizarre stories. And anyway, I just don't know. The doctor gave me a bunch of Librium, and I made the mistake, though, of sharing this with my soon-to-be sponsor. And he informed me if I was going to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous as opposed to one that's just didn't drink but are going to be sober and be in a position to work this program like turn your life and your will into his care. You can't do it when you're drinking, obviously, and you can't do it when you're taking pills or any other stuff that they have around available to us, and we just don't take the first drink. And if you have to take one drink, that's okay. Just delay it till after the meeting, or till after dinner, or till you get up in the morning, or till after work, or just keep delaying it. Just keep putting it off. Before you know it, you have a whole day, or maybe a couple of days, or a week, or whatever it is. And I've done little else then come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not taken a drink. I got this guy as a sponsor, and I've got on this journey that we're on. And I just, what was that?
Oh,
some spirit of a newcomer, no doubt. But I got very active on the program. I went to meetings every night during the first year of my sobriety, probably the second time. I wasn't able to work the program very much other than come to meetings, but to hang with these newcomers, these guys and gals that we all got sober with, and we go out for coffee and do all that sort of stuff and talk about our problems in life and relationships and all that sort of stuff and share what little stuff we had to share with each other. And little by little by little, we got through it all. My wife and I reconciled some naive idea that we were going to go to, she was going to go to Al-Anon and get the kids to go to Al-Ateen and Al-Atot, get the dog to go to Al-Pet, and all this stuff, but it's not going to happen. She couldn't see the need for Al-Anon in her life. Was, after all, my problem. And she continued on with her psychologist, and I went to AA. And there was a certain amount of a honeymoon those first few months. It doesn't last very long, but I was sober about 8 or 9 months. I'd gone to a very up speaker meeting like this one is, and I loved the meeting that night, just as crazy as I've ever been or been since. I was crying and laughing and just crazy. And I went down to Santa Monica Beach trying to sort it all out, and I couldn't. And I ended up at my sponsor's house quite late that night. In fact, I even got him out of bed. And he came to the front door and wanted to know why I was parked on his front lawn. I said, I haven't got time to park the car. I got to talk to you. I got to talk to you now. Anyway, he made me park the car in the street with the rest of the cars. And I sponsor a lot of guys, and that's our job. As a sponsor, we have magic sentences. That's our job. And you come to us with a problem or two, and we lay one of these magic sentences on you. Or a very serious problem, maybe two magic sentences. Well, this particular night, he was fresh out. He didn't have it. He told me to go home and do a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, because it was time. And I didn't see how it applied to me. I spent so much of my life in the Catholic system of examination of conscience and confession. If that's not a fourth or fifth step, what is? Years that I spent in psychiatrist's offices talking about what I used to be like, what happened, what I'm like now. And he cursed me and embarrassed me, and against my better judgment, I had to go home and start this fourth step. I was able to put in that fourth step things I was never able to tell a Catholic priest in confession because they were too tacky, too embarrassing, too sinful, things that I couldn't tell a psychiatrist. You can't tell them that kind of stuff. They'll think you're crazy. So you've got to be very guarded what you tell people in those venues. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Put all that crap down. Put your goals down. Find out who the hell you're dealing with. So much of my life was spent in fantasy land and let's pretend and always wanted to be any other place than where I was. And I just wasn't until after I got on this journey of uncovering, discovering, and discarding, of trusting God, cleaning house, and helping others is what we do here, is that I had some semblance of feeling pretty good about Tom Whalen for the first time in my life. I felt there was something worth saving, and maybe there was a little bit of hope at the end. I don't know why I was so fortunate. I got the message early on. I went to meetings for 10 days and continued to drink because I didn't think it was possible. And then all of a sudden I thought, I'll give it a try. And it's hard to believe. It's been over 41 years that I've been doing this whole thing. And I just, to me it's awesome. It's remarkable that I've been sober that long. And as I say, I've done little else than just do the stuff that's laid out for us to do. I did a fifth step with this man. And I didn't think he was going to like me when it was over with, because it was full of tacky, awful stuff in there. And he seemed rather bored through it all, as if he had heard it all before. And of course he had. I've heard so many of them, and they're all about the same. They're kind of sad, really, just about guys who would, you know, try to do all this stuff to make themselves feel better and maybe do the right thing if they can and fail miserably and getting drunk and on and over and over and over again. And not having any way to go. And when it was over with, he told me to get to a first place I could find, which was a service station men's room. And I went in there and locked the door and got on my knees and did a sixth and a seventh step, because he told me to do it as soon as possible. And then I embarked from using my four-step. I wrote the list of people I had harmed, which is our eight-step. I didn't mind walking up to somebody and saying, hey, I'm sorry, just kidding. But when it came to my business, my electrical contracting business, and my financial stuff, I didn't say how it applied. I don't know how. I was sitting in a meeting for almost a year, and I just lost it. I didn't hear it. I don't know what it is. I think Chuck used to say, you can't hear till you can hear. Anyway, I was having lunch with a friend of mine who is sober for a long, long time. And he wanted me to go home and open up that drawer and get out those bills. And I wonder how the hell I knew about that drawer. I didn't tell him about it. Which I did, and I consolidated all these bills, and I went to all these different people, and it took me 11 and a half years to get out of debt. Would have been a lot sooner if I'd been a little bit more fearless and thorough. But it took what it took, and I've been in and out of debt ever since, kind of like the American way. And I got through all that whole thing, and I maintained a certain activity in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I feel very fortunate that I did. A lot of times people slough off or they drop back or whatever. I have never done that. Maybe it's just because I've had the gift of enjoying the meetings and the people and all that sort of stuff. And I did that. And I looked around when I was sober almost 8 years, and these two little toe-head children were now getting out of high school. Both of them stoned out of their minds. Both of them selling drugs out the back door. You couldn't walk in the living room without getting contact high. Both drug addict alcoholics. I mean, it was just a zoo. My youngest son said our family gave a whole new meaning to dysfunctional. And my wife was going along with what the kids were doing, and it was just, you know, me against them. And that January of 74 is when my wife filed for divorce. And that's when I moved down to Dana Point, where I live near now. And as I was driving down the freeway, I was thinking, am I doing my will or his will? When you're around here a while, you don't want to screw this thing up. You want to do it correctly. And so I said a prayer that my sponsor gave me. I'll share it with you. It goes like this. God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me, and I cannot know for certain where it'll end. Nor do we know myself. And the fact I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do. And I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it at the time, or may seem to be lost. In the very shadow of death, I'll not be afraid. Because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. With this, I continued on down the freeway. And, of course, I immediately told him what kind of apartment I wanted. The business would be running. You don't do this stuff. You just practice it. And I got down to Dana Point, and I got myself a nicer apartment, a lot less money. And I started life all over again. I was about 3.5 minutes too late for the Yellow Pages, so that meant a whole year without any advertising, which was really difficult. And back and forth to Los Angeles and missing the kids and kind of relieved that I wasn't around them both at the same time, you know. And it was a very difficult year, but I got through it. We get through anything. As Jennifer said so eloquently in her wonderful talk, you know, if you're doing this alone, you're doing it wrong. I mean, this is a we program. This is what we do together. And it really is true. I know a lot of people feel, well, hell, I can handle it. I can do all that stuff by myself. Well, no, you do it with other people. And it helps them and it helps you. Anyway, I excuse me. I started a date again, which is a little awkward. I wasn't too good at it when I was in high school, much less in my early 40s. And I met a girl, and we dated for a while, and then we broke it off. I broke it off. It was too hot and heavy. But she called me in August, which is our natal birthdays were right together. I'm the 19th and hers is the 20th. And she invited me out to dinner to celebrate our birthdays. And so I thought, okay, I'll go out to dinner. I'm very romantic. And so, a free meal. Anyway, we hit it off again. And we started to go together, and when she was having a radical mastectomy in January of 75, no, that's not true, January 77, I went to visit her. I said, where are you going to move to? well, she didn't want to go here. And I said, come home with me, and I'll take care of you until you start to feel better, which she did. And, of course, the relationship intensified. We were ultimately married. We had a very good marriage. It was kind of dumb to marry somebody that had terminal cancer, but that's my story. And it was a very trying time, but we had a good marriage, I think. The only real problem in that marriage were my two drug addict, alcoholic children coming to visit us, and her three daughters and a son who were not much better condition than my kids are in. And they love to come to visit us in their various stages of stoneness. some perverse joy they got out of that, I'm sure. But they're all sober today, those that are still alive. And my youngest son, when he fell out of a second-story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, I went to visit him in General Hospital up in East L.A., and I invited him to come down to Dana Point and get himself a place to live and come to work for me, which he did eventually. And he stayed sober in front of me because he knew I wouldn't have anybody in my business that was loaded. And he got picked up one Saturday night for drunk walking. And when he got out of the Santa Ana jail, he realized he had to quit drinking. He did it all on his own with no problem. Just cut it off completely. Did it all on Quaaludes and marijuana, which is another whole program. And I invited him to one of my home groups, which is the Wednesday night speaker meeting of in Laguna Beach. He loved the meeting, and especially the speaker. I invited him for the entertainment value mainly. It was Norm Alpe, who was our best speaker in those days. And he loved it. And he came back, and he got sober right away. And he stayed sober for 26 years. And being that he's HIV positive, it's not an excuse, but this is what happened. And all the junk they give you to ward off whatever. He got a lot of pain and different manifestations of the HIV, and he started taking the pills more than prescribed. Instead of taking them just at night, he took them during the day, and ended up, last year was a horrible year. This all happened a year ago, last February, and he went back out again, ended up drinking again, getting picked up by the cops, and his sobriety date is last July. He's coming up on a year, I guess, next month, hopefully. And my other son, who is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, will have 25 years this coming December. His wife of about 14 years came to him after my two little grandchildren and said she didn't love him, never had loved him, and wanted a divorce. And it's been a horrible, horrible, horrible year. And I see the futility of trying to, you know how to put your little daddy hat on or your AA hat and how to handle the whole thing. You want the best for your kids, and you want to do for them if you can, as much as you can, but you realize the futility of it all. And you just have to turn them over to God and let them go where they're going to go. And things are better now. This year is a better year than last year. That's all you can hope for. I was looking back on my second marriage to this lady, and she, after seven surgeries and constant chemotherapy and radiation, if you've been with anybody that suffered and died with cancer, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know, you really don't want to know. And she passed away the day after Christmas of 1985. And I was devastated when that happened. I thought, how can this be? You know, and I was maybe very naive, I don't know. But I'd done a third step on her cancer, and she died anyway. I mean, there's something wrong with this picture. And 1986 was a terrible year for me. I had no joy. I did all this AA shit and went to work and did all the stuff that you do and all that kind of stuff. I just suited up and showed up and did all the stuff that I had to do. Not gratefully, but I did it. And I got through 1986, and then it dawned on me that I had done a third step. And that the third step, yes, 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 it does work. It says, my God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. of thy power, thy love, thy way of life, may I do thy will always. And so I realized that it had worked and that I had done it. And I had a much better time after that. And I've been put into a position that I can help people. I've had experiences in sobriety that I know what it's like to go through all these different things. And that's what makes me valuable to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've had these experiences and stayed sober through them all, and I know what's going on. That's what we do here. I'd much rather be home. I've had a very hard week working, a physically hard week, and I mean, I'm just worn out, and I thought I can't drive all the way down to wherever I am. But because I was asked, and because on the calendar I'm here, and that's just the way I am. But anyway, I don't know. I took a couple of years off, and I was sitting at my Wednesday night meeting, and I saw this beautiful blonde lady get her fifth cake. I said, "Now there is an attractive looking lady," and I happened to be sitting right next to her sponsor, and I said, "Who's that?" She said, "Oh, that's Gloria." "So you think she'd like to go out?" And he said, "Yeah, I think you guys have hit it off pretty well." And we went out on one date, and we've been together ever since. And I was telling the boys at dinner that we've been married 19 years and about 3 months, and we have a wonderful life. And it's phenomenal where my life has taken me. I piss and moan with the best of them, and I complain and do the whole thing. I've had an odd shot of gratitude this last few weeks, realizing, you know, my age and what I do for a living, that I'm able to get up and down ladders and crawl around in attics and underneath houses and all that sort of stuff. I go to the gym 5 days a week, and in fact, I was in the gym last August, and a guy in the change room said, "Seem very happy today, Tom. What's going on?" I said, "Well, today's my birthday." "Well, how old are you today, Tom?" And I said, 43. And one of the guys in the back, he says, "Well, you don't look it." And I worry about how much longer can I work and how much longer can I do this and that, have all the stuff, and on and on and on and on. And basically, I'm living in the wreckage of my future. And instead of doing which I'm able to do, and it's easier for me because I've been doing it so long. I think a lot of than the newer people in the room is that I've been practicing this whole thing for a long time, and I just know the value of living in the now and just taking care of today and just what we have to do now and whatever, and not living, you know, sometime in the future. And I love my life, and I wish it upon you, especially the new people tonight. I hope you keep coming back and find that you can live a very good life. And you don't have to put that crap in your system anymore, and you can at least have some hope. Thank you very much.